February 9th meeting of the Joint Committee on Implementation of Measure 91 come to order. We have some wonderful guests here with us today who are going to offer their perspectives and help us make sure we understand two key issues well. The two key issues that we're going to be talking about tonight are steps that we can take to help prevent youth from becoming involved with marijuana, prevention steps, and the other thing we're going to be taking a close look at tonight is lab regulations and sort of common standards that labs that are measuring the intensity and the purity of product might use, and whether that would be a helpful step for us across both across kind of the whole sector to establish some consistent standards and practices. We are going to start, because we have a lot of people, we're going to start right away. We may have a committee member or two coming up, and I'm going to read out to you right now the order in case anyone doesn't know the order in which they're coming forward. First, we're going to have Richard Harris, former head of Addiction and Mental Health Services for the state of Oregon. Representative Alyssa Kenny Geyer is going to follow Jen Urich and Jen Michaels Van Alken, something like that. And then Allie Maffei from Colorado, where they've done some interesting prevention work, is going to call in by phone toward the end of this is our first hour. So, Mr. Harris, if you will join us at the front, and Representative Kenny Geyer, if you would come up too, that would be great. And we will get started. Thank you so much for being with us today. So with that, I'll open an informational session on the issue of steps we can take to help youth avoid involvement with marijuana.
Good evening, committee and Chair Leininger and co-chair Senator Burdick. I'm really happy to be here.
And if you could identify yourself for the record, that'd be great. Thanks.
Richard Harris. Been in the business of alcohol and drug treatment for over 40 years, and now retired and getting rest finally. So it seems a little strange to be down here doing this all over. We'll see where this goes. I am happy to be here, however, because I think this is a really important issue, and I want to talk about prevention because it's implicit in the Measure 91, and it's also explicit in Measure 91. So first of all, I would say that I've had a lot of experience with providing direct treatment of addicts and alcoholics, program development, policy work, worked for Central City Concern for 30 years, 15 years as executive director, and then 3.5 years as the mental health and addictions director for the state of Oregon. And during that period of time, I have seen and know thousands of people in recovery from addictions, and so I'm pretty clear about, I know the treatment works, and I know that people who have had serious addictions can return to a very productive life. And coming from that place, I believe that in Measure 91, that what we have is a real opportunity to make some changes in the way we are dealing with people who use marijuana and marijuana itself. So it's an opportunity that we need to take hold of and make sure that we do this right and that we are successful. And part of that, being successful with this, is to make sure that we have a handle on how we do prevention so that we keep young people in the category of not using marijuana at an early age, and that for people who are legally able to use marijuana, that they understand what the risks are for them as adults. So we're moving from what was a prohibition period of over 77 years, as I count them, from when the federal government declared marijuana to be a dangerous drug and prohibited its use legally. And so with this measure in Oregon, as in Colorado and Washington, we're changing the game here. We're going to a public health model, which is based on regulation. And it's based on, public health is based on education, it's based on prevention, and it's based on treatment. So we have shifted over from a legal approach to solving the problem of marijuana use to a public health approach. And for me, that's a really important step to take forward, that we now think about this as a way that we can manage the substance in a way that it causes least harm to individuals and the community. So that in a system of regulation, education, prevention, intervention, and treatment, we know that you can start with examples and be cleared and see how this works pretty obviously. So tobacco use, for instance. With tobacco use, we have experienced in the last decade a major decline in the use of tobacco because of the education and the prevention activities that are gone on, as well as treatment. We also know that other public health issues like brain injury for children, when we passed a law requiring them to wear helmets, that it slowed down and changed the whole dynamic around how young people could be injured with bicycle accidents. So there's countless examples of the interplay between regulation and prevention activities, regulation, education, and prevention.
Mr. Harris, can I jump in for 1 second? I just want to give you a heads up. We have about 5 more minutes for your testimony, so want to make sure we get all the key points in.
You want me to get to the bottom?
You are right in process.
Well, I just think that it's important to acknowledge that we're on a new course here, and we're all trying to figure out what's the best way to go. I'd say that this measure actually sets us up to do the right thing, because it, in fact, has a user tax in it, and that user tax, which is not too dissimilar to the alcohol, beer, and wine tax that we know about. It's divided, has a formula and everything that goes with it. But in this case, it designates that we pay attention to treatment and prevention. And in that formula, it's pretty clear that there's a significant funding source now to propel Oregon into a first-class prevention program, something that is comprehensive. Right now in the state of Oregon, the state puts $0 into prevention. What the state does is it uses the federal block grant to pay for most prevention activities, in addition to what communities, cities, counties, nonprofits create in their own communities to fund the prevention activities. But the state of Oregon has not funded prevention activities in the whole time I've been here, and I'm pretty completely certain this is true, that and that's over 35 years I've been here, that the state doesn't invest in prevention. That needs to be changed. We now have the vehicle to do that. And what I would like to urge everybody here is to understand that with some additional revenues to the taxes that are going to be supporting this, that we can go forward. And we need to be doing it now. We don't want to wait 2 years from now for the tax revenues to appear so they can be allocated to provide prevention programs. Oregon is kind of funny this way. It has two of the nation's top prevention professional academics here. Tony Bigland at the Oregon Research Institute and Dennis McCarty at OHSU are both acknowledged across the country as being in the leaders of the way prevention programs and prevention strategies. We haven't taken advantage of that. We really need to do that, and we're now given the opportunity to actually produce a prevention program that has substance to it, that can be uniform throughout the state, Right now, if you go into some communities, there's a real active prevention activities happening there, but it doesn't happen across the state because these are all local programs. And it's not that we're doing bad things. We're just not funding an adequate infrastructure to do the right kind of prevention. And it's critical that we do prevention, in this case, targeted to youth, and not forget about education for adults, because there's a lot of education that's going to be necessary for the retail consumer in this case. A lot of people who may not know what they're getting into, they need to be advised and be clear about what it is. So the rest of the legislation, or the rest of the measure, is also essential about regulating the substances and labeling and testing its potency and so forth and so on. So we're kind of at a crossroads, and I think this is a great opportunity. I just add one little part to this, and that is if you look at the funding formula, it identifies 5% of the funds to go to the Oregon Health Authority for treatment, prevention, and early intervention. And 5% isn't going to be a whole lot of money. But then there's 25% or 20% in the drug and alcohol account. And as I understand it, not to make too strong a point of this, but addictions and mental health is part of the Oregon Health Authority. So there's 25% of the tax revenue raised for this that can go to prevention. And I would just say as a sidelight to this is that we have a system to provide treatment, and we don't necessarily need to dump a lot more money into that because it's part of the Oregon Health Plan. When somebody comes forward now, they have opportunity to get treatment, and they need it. And I'm not certain that there needs to be specialized treatment for marijuana users. In the 9 years I ran the Hooper Detox Center, and in the many years I provided treatment, we never detoxed anybody from marijuana. Marijuana was part of a larger use of drugs. People came in and had used heroin, also used marijuana or alcohol, lots of different things. My point is that you could use a lot of money for prevention, and this is a way to do it and do it right.
Well, thank you, and what a beautiful way to end at the end of that final 5 minutes. Thank you, sir. Do we have questions right now, or shall we proceed to Representative Kenny Geyer?
I was going to say, why don't we do the panel?
All right, great. So, Representative Kenny Geyer, thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Co-Chair Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Vice Chairs, and committee members. I'm Alyssa Kenny Geyer, and I represent House District 46, parts of Southeast and Northeast Portland. I have a public health background, and my particular passion is really looking after the well-being, the health and well-being of women and children. And I'm very honored to testify after Richard because I have huge respect for the work that you've done in your career, and I pretty much agree with everything he just said. My main purpose here today is actually to introduce the speakers who are going to be coming after me, who are focused particularly on making sure that we prevent and mitigate risks to pregnant women in particular and children. I have two legislative concepts that I've been working on with them. One goes at the issue that Richard was talking about, that we can't wait 2 years until the revenue comes in to start doing some of the prevention education. Once people know that the marijuana is legal, we want to make sure people don't get a mixed message and kids think, oh, all of a sudden they don't need to be concerned about the safety risks. So we have an appropriations bill that I'm working on with Representative Leininger as well to make sure that we start directing money toward Department of Education for education programs, prevention programs in the schools, as well as Oregon Health Authority to do prevention for the greater audience, particularly women and children, pregnant women and children. I just want to say, for the record, that I supported the dispensary bill because I do believe that we need to shift from a legal, emphasis on things being illegal and making it hard for people to get to a public health emphasis. And so supporting dispensaries, meaning that people who had a medical marijuana permit could get safe, reliable marijuana that had been checked for pesticides and fungus and things like that, I thought is in the best interest, the best public health interest of our state. And likewise, I supported Measure 91. I don't think that the system that we have now making legal has protected our kids, but I have always said that it's very important to me, if that measure passed, that we look at both the medical marijuana and the recreational marijuana to ensure that we have as many safeguards as possible. So with that, I hope that you can ask any questions you like, but quickly turn it over and make sure that the folks from Sparrow Strategy have a chance to talk about the work that they've done in Colorado exactly along this line. We can get the lessons learned that they've done. They have an excellent PowerPoint presentation on the risk to children and some of the steps that Oregon should be taking to address that. Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Does anyone have a question for Mr. Harris right now? And if not, we can proceed to the completion of this panel, which is the Jen Urich and Jen Van Arkel, who are going to talk about some exciting prevention work that they helped design in Colorado, which, as you know, is, you know, a good year or so ahead of us in terms of implementation. And they have encountered some issues around youth getting access to marijuana, and they're trying to help minimize that and prevent that. So I want to ask, it's a little cattywampus, as my mother would say, but does anyone have a question for Mr. Harris at the moment? And I'm sure he would be willing to come back up, or can we wait until we hear?
Madam Chair, if I might.
Yes, sir.
The unwritten rule is once you leave the dais, you've escaped.
Yeah.
He's coming back up.
Come back up if you want.
Stay there. Not yet.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, wonderful. So we have about 10 minutes for your presentation, too, and I would love to have you introduce yourselves and talk about how you came to be involved with this work and your ideas for Oregon as we move forward.
Thank you for having us. We are Jen and Jen, and we are storytellers. So without further ado, we're going to tell you a story.
Full names.
Oh, yes. Could you please introduce your full names for the record?
Jennifer Urich of Sparrow Strategy.
I'm Jen Michaelis Van Arkel, also of Sparrow Strategy.
And are you constituents of Representative Kenny Geyer? Is that?
No, I am in Northwest Portland.
Okay.
I'm in Southeast Portland.
Okay. Well, welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us. So we are coming to you today representing some and ready to share some learning from some research that we did in the state of Colorado last year.
So we have one single-minded concern. We're not going to talk about prenatal pregnant women. We're going to focus on kids today. And we want to do something about marijuana and kids in Oregon. We're moms. There's Sarah.
Oh, hi.
We're citizens and real-world researchers. There's Jen with some kids. And we're 21st century communication experts in youth, public health, and education with deep experience in, and I'm not going to be shy here, stunningly effective social marketing. I was part of the original anti-tobacco campaign, Truth, that was launched in the state of Florida. And we've worked for the University of Oregon, we've worked for Nike, we've worked for Planned Parenthood, we've worked for the governor of Colorado, and that's why we're here today. We have relevant knowledge. This was the challenge that Governor Hickenlooper gave us. It was January 10th of last year. He convened his task force in 2012. In December 2012, he worked all of 2013 with his task force to take on the issues with a particular focus on this question. What can we tell the kids of Colorado to get them to stop and think twice about using marijuana? That was it, single-minded question.
So today we're going to answer that question by looking at three different issues. First, we want to talk a little bit about why marijuana is a public health issue in the state of Oregon. We want to tell you a little bit of learning that we got from Colorado about marijuana in kids, and then we also want to quickly share three recommendations that we have for you moving forward in your work based on the learning that we have. But first, we want you to meet Nathan. He is one of the kids that we met.
We're depending on Adam's expertise here.
We're all in trouble.
Adam?
Sorry, we're researchers, but not tech experts.
All of this has been put up on the intranet, I believe, as well, by Roberto. Nathan liked to get stoned, so that could possibly be what's happening. I also have them all on a separate key drive.
Should we just keep moving? Okay.
Yeah.
So Nathan's story, which at some point I hope you will take the time to watch, it's a short clip. He is a freshman, and he's from Colorado Springs, and this little clip just talks about how, when and how he first smoked weed. And he's a young guy, so it's just, it's pretty telling of exactly what's happening. Nathan.
Where we hang out there a lot, Bancroft Park, as I talked about. I actually just started smoking recently.
How recently?
Like the beginning of school.
Oh, so September
this year. Yeah.
It's the first place you smoked, right?
Yes, I smoked right there.
Who'd you smoke with when you were here?
My friend Dame and my girlfriend at the time, Onita.
Was it their first times also, or
no?
Just yours.
I wasn't sure what I was supposed to do, actually.
Did you ever smoke and go to school? At Stone?
There were a couple times.
How was that?
I smoked before school, before I got on the bus. And I went to school.
What percentage of your friends do you think smoke?
90.
90?
90%.
What about the kids that you hang out that don't smoke? Do you guys ever, like, do they feel peer pressured too, or they just...
They don't really feel peer pressured. They just have their own opinion about it.
So, oops. That's not ours.
You might want to sit here with us.
Our presentation just went. That's fine.
So let's have you about that. Keep going with your presentation. Okay. Thanks.
So there are a lot of kids like Nathan in Oregon, and according to recent data from the Oregon Department of Justice, Oregon ranked fourth in the country for cannabis use by people 12 and older, with most consumers between age 18 and 25. And that age range is really key, because that's part of the prime time when the brain is still developing. Marijuana use in the past 30 days, you can see that it kind of ramps up in eighth grade and continues to increase through 11th grade and beyond. In the last 30 days, use among 11th graders, 59% of the kids were using three or more times. That's starting to get to be a lot. So marijuana use is already a public health issue. This is before any of this discussion started and the bill was passed. Next, we'd like to share some of the key learning from our research in Colorado, and the first part being why kids are even using marijuana. These days, again, from the kids' perspective, marijuana is really normalized. It's all over. It's in pop culture. It's in the shops that they're around, and it's in, obviously, the news and the media. It's also been popularized. I don't know how many people in this room have kids, but BuzzFeed is a really popular part of their life, and this is just one thing. They have 88 things that are much better to do when you're high, so it's part of their conversation. It's also not seen as something that is of high risk. It's just pot. It's a natural herb. It's very low on the danger line in terms of their perception, and it continues to go down even as use increases.
And just to let you know, this list of drugs came from the kids themselves. We asked them, you know, what are some drugs? And they went on to a pharmacopoeia of things that we had never even heard of. So these kids are cognizant of drug language options. It's a whole new vocabulary.
They're smoking not for the same reasons that people used to smoke, that kids used to smoke in previous generations. These days, kids are turning to weed a lot for stress relief. You know, they're being a teenager is a stressful time, but especially now, they have a lot of pressures on them, and a lot of them are turning to weed for stress relief. So if you don't happen to know of a kid who's using weed right now, let's look at kind of who might be using. In our research, we kind of unveiled a spectrum of use across kids, and kids' relationship and their evolution or their relationship with weed evolves as they sort of go through their teen years and through their exposure to weed. So they'll start out often, you know, when they're young, really innocent. At that point in time, weed is really theoretical. It's just kind of bad. But as they get exposed to it, it becomes something that's really real, and they have to make that choice of whether they're going to use it or not. At that point, if they choose to use it, then they become experienced, and then it becomes either a cyclical thing where they, you know, may use it and then stop using it, or some of them, as we, this kid on the far right, he's actually moved on from weed and he's now using prescription drugs. So it can either become something that they're dependent on, or it's just a really slippery slope in this. I'm going to turn it over to Jen. She's going to talk more about what to say to kids to help them think twice about using weed.
So when it comes to marijuana and kids, what gets through to them? We had the kids do a debate. Weed's okay, weed's not okay. We usually got the stoner kids to take the it's not okay side, and they had a hard time struggling with that because they had always been on the weed's okay side. We had, what question would you ask for the world's smartest weed expert? So what gets through to them? Of all of the things that came out, and we talked to over 100 kids in Colorado, loving your brain popped to the top. And Dr. Paula Riggs is one of the experts we spoke to. She's going to talk to you and lead off what we've discovered about brain development, brains, kids, marijuana. We've spoken to people at OHSU here, too. Bonnie Nagel's an expert locally who's very similar to Dr. Riggs.
Regular use in adolescents has been shown to shave about 6 to 8 points off your adult IQ, and it looks like you don't get it back. That's a public health emergency in my mind.
When I say to them, you know, we know that regular use in adolescence, number one, the earlier you start using, the more long-term effects there are. You do lose IQ points. You know, they were very, like, wow, interested.
Because I didn't actually know that.
You didn't know that?
Yeah, I always thought, like, your brain cells die and then they just go back.
So why do kids love their brains? I think that kids really do understand that that's what makes them who they are.
The brain contains who we are, what we are, and our thoughts and emotions and all that. So it gets to them when you say, if you're consuming, you might not have the opportunities you would like.
I want to be smart.
Yeah.
I'm curious about the effects on the brain. Like, that's big for me. Like, that's something I would want to get out there and just for people to know on how it affects a child's brain.
To have 8 points knocked off your IQ, you're only 13. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're like a lot of school still to go, and mm-hmm. if you're not retaining most of that, it's gonna not make you so like smart in college.
Me personally, I want children to think about why don't I want to do pot, not scare them away from it. I want them to be educated and to say this isn't for me.
Yeah, knowing some of the facts might help people realize that if you're smoking 4 times a day, that it's not going to really help you, and it will affect your brain.
Killing your brain cells, it's affecting the way you learn and process things. Mm-hmm. So you're going to be like, it's kind of like making you like almost like more stupider, like when you smoke.
Well, you want to set your opportunities high, so getting distracted by weed, it's just going to make your opportunities lower.
I think it said that it ruins one of your brain cells or something. So I wouldn't want to lose education just for a drug to have fun. I don't think there's a point in that.
I'm going to college and hopefully going to med school later on. I need as much brain power as I can have. If I would have known that, I probably wouldn't have smoked pot.
So once again, the governor of Colorado asked us to answer one question: what could we tell them to make them stop and think twice about marijuana? I don't know why that one keeps wanting to come up. But the answer was my amazing, beautiful brain, and why a brain approach would be a really smart messaging strategy. It's the only one I've got. It's key to me. It's mine for life. Weed will do irreparable harm to it. It's not your brain on drugs that we all saw in 1990. It's their brain. And that made all the difference. They really care about their heads.
So we've probably got
this
about
is a, two or three more minutes.
Okay, and we'll zoom. This is the first campaign ad that they ran in Colorado after, based on this strategy. You can find the entire campaign online at Don't Be a Lab Rat. Three recommendations for Oregon. We are doing this because we came back from Colorado and we care about Oregon. Number one, prioritize youth protection in your interpretation and implementation of Prop 91. And this is exactly what Richard just said. That means look at labeling, look at marketing. Willamette Week recently said, their comments on an article said, oh, no, they've got the kids covered. Selling, protecting kids from buying marijuana is not the same as protecting them from marketing, being marketed to. Remember, big tobacco. Location strategy, edibles, hash oil, and then funding. And we're going to go into detail on the funding. That's the next slide. Where will the money go? And this was from Prop 91. We've been trying to figure out that rat's nest for a while, but you guys know you've got 40, 35, 25. We want you to commit to a marijuana prevention effort to inform, support, and treat kids. You can consider a holistic program like what Oregon Health Authority did for the MORE program, which is an anti-youth drinking program. This is a little bit more detail about what we mean by inform. So there's a campaign aspect in terms of what Colorado did. Support them through guidance counseling. Treat them, as Dr. Harris said. We've got examples of fantastic programs. In Colorado, the number three, that what happened there is in 2012, they got to work. In 2014, they launched the campaign. Secure time and money, $4.5 million is an estimate for a kid-focused communication effort. That is just the prevention campaign. And we've provided background as to where those numbers came from. It's based on the population of kids in Oregon and based on the funding that Colorado asked for. The governor was the one who got the funding for the original program. It then shifted to the Department of Health. Allie will be able to tell you about that, too. I believe she was in our initial strategy sessions. So how much money? You can look into the details. Last one is, it's now more than ever, marijuana is a public health and education issue. As the kids said, they're going to school. On the one hand, you're spending money here to educate them, and on the other hand, you need to spend money to protect those brains that you're also trying to grow. So it's not just a public health issue, it is an education issue. Kids are self-medicating, they're unwittingly hurting their brain, and this goes from 0 to 25, and they deserve to be informed, supported, and treated. The last one that we want to leave you with, Miranda.
After you start, you kind of start to realize that not everyone's doing it, and it does have some negative side effects that you never saw. No one ever told you about them.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Does anybody have questions for these presenters at this time?
Yeah, Madam Chair, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
So, either Jen. So, you mentioned when the slide of continuum was up there, which I thought was kind of interesting, you kind of closed your conversation on that it's just a slippery slope. So I guess through all your interviews and research, did the youth kind of give you an idea? Because this seems to be a debate that's all over the board. Is it a gateway drug?
We explored that a little bit. I think there are going to be differing opinions on that. We are by no means addiction experts. Mr. Harris would be able to answer that better. But particularly with the experts that we spoke with, that's actually with some direct language that came from them. And it's really about how can you catch these kids and, first of all, arm them with the information that they need to be able to make a smart decision on their own. Really trust and respect them as individuals that they would be able to make the right choice for themselves. And if they can't do that, then offer support within a familiar environment. The school was a great example of some programs in Colorado that were doing that. And then to be able to kind of catch them when they fell off that slippery slope. And it's the teen peer pressure is just so tough.
And also, there are many other factors in their lives besides just drugs. So home situation, genetic tendency, and this is in the report that we gave to Colorado, but there's so many different factors. Often it comes down to, are you loved? Either by a parent, by a teacher, by a coach, and that made all the difference.
Well, I don't see any other hands, and I want to thank you for your presentation. I think that, you know, we in Oregon are where we are. We, by a strong majority, passed Measure 91, and I think we, at the same time, are a community of people, wherever you were on Measure 91, who know that we want to help educate our kids so that kids are not making a decision to move into adult recreational products at a time when their brains are still growing. So thank you for being here with us. We really appreciate it. And now we're going to hear from the governor's office one of the leaders of the public health authority in Colorado, who has served in a strong coordination role in their prevention efforts. Again, they're about a year ahead of us in terms of rolling out and dealing with issues of kid engagement. So we've got Allie Maffei coming up. And she has a PowerPoint. So we can't see Allie, but we can see her PowerPoint.
Good evening, everybody.
Hi, Ms. Maffei. This is Ann Leininger. I am the co-chair of our Measure 91, our Marijuana Implementation Committee, and we're really honored to have you here today. If I could get you to introduce yourself for the record, we would love to hear what you have to say about things we should be thinking about to keep our kids to prevent our kids from engaging in marijuana use as young people, and any learnings you have to offer.
Wonderful. My name is Allie Maffei. I am the Policy and Communication Unit Supervisor in the Violence and Injury Prevention and Mental Health Promotion Branch within the State Health Department. And the retail marijuana education program was placed within our branch and my unit based on Senate Bill 14215. Which passed the Colorado State Legislature last spring, and that was the bill that allocated all of the retail marijuana sales tax revenue at the state level to the various state agencies to be able to implement aspects of retail marijuana, either licensure, monitoring, enforcement, or in my case, public education and prevention.
Excellent. Well, we have a PowerPoint that your name is on here in Salem, and we have someone here operating the controls, so just to go ahead and walk us through, if you would, please.
All right. So on slide 2, you will see a reference to that Senate bill, 14215, which authorized our program, and if anyone has interest, you can go to the Colorado State Legislature website and be able to read the full legislation of how the sales tax revenue is used. But our program that was written into statute, the vision really is that we ensure all Colorado residents and visitors understand the parameters of safe, legal, and responsible use of retail marijuana. And this has become our mantra through all of our efforts since, you know, we do work for the government and the voters passed Amendment 64 in our state, it is our role to implement the will of the people with as few public health, public safety, and other concerns possible. So we feel that this kind of rallying cry is a place that we're able to bring a variety of stakeholders together, because this is something that people on all sides of the issue agree with, that implementation should be safe, it should be legal, it should maintain the parameters of what is legal, and encourage responsible use. Retail marijuana, we have found, is very important to continue to emphasize, because in our state, the rules and laws are very different around retail and medical, and so to really make sure that we emphasize that our work is around the retail aspects. So if you move to slide 3, I'll walk you through our legislative mandate. There are 5 key components that we were tasked with. The first being an 18-month campaign on the health effects of marijuana and what legal use is. This 18-month campaign must, according to legislation, it's repealed June 30th, 2016, which meant we had to launch in January 2015. And so you may have heard of the Good to Know campaign, and that was what launched on January 5th. And it's mostly focusing on the laws at this point. A side note on the health effects, our state health department was also tasked with creating the Retail Marijuana Public Health Advisory Committee, which is a group of 13 medical and public health professionals which have researched, through systematic literature reviews, all of the health effects of what we're willing to say marijuana can and cannot do or cause within the body, from the recreational use aspect. So they're not reviewing literature on the medical benefits, but just from recreational use, since that's what the group was convened to do. That report was just released about a week ago on January 30th. It went to the press on February 2nd. It was the first public health topic to ever hit number one on Reddit that evening. So it's made the rounds. A lot of people are quite familiar with it now. And through their systematic literature review, they identified kind of those components of what we can say. You know, we keep hearing from different people, but it does this, but it does this, but it does this. And so this is the research that we're going to be grounding our campaigns in moving forward. You will see Spanish language this spring, and I probably should have written that a little bit better. We're actually working on a trans-created version of the campaign. Good to Know is not a concept that translates, so you're not simply it's not a phrase that is commonly said in Spanish, and so we're not just translating the campaign, we're actually going to transcreate it so it's culturally relevant. The second aspect of the second component that we were tasked with in legislation includes ongoing education and prevention campaign that educates retailers on preventing youth access, educates on the overconsumption of edibles, and also, it does say in our legislation, continues the work of the 18-month campaign to educate the general public on the health effects and the laws. And then it also says that we are to target high-risk populations. In statute, it doesn't outline who those high-risk populations are, but through the research of that Retail Marijuana Public Health Advisory Committee, we've identified the first three, I'm not sure that the fourth is in their report, just because there's not a lot of data available on it yet. But the risk of marijuana use or exposure to young children is both kind of youth prevention as well as parent safe storage. And then the risks associated for pregnant women is also another high-risk area. We will continue to monitor their research. It's not a one-time committee. This is just their first report. And so we will continue to monitor what they come out with related to the health effects and related to hospitalizations, emergency department visits, and other areas of concern. Hash oil extractions is something that does make the news quite a bit. It has high risk for both property and life. And so it is something that we're considering the best way to educate the public on those concerns. Moving on to slide 4. We were tasked with maintenance of the web portal colorado.gov/marijuana. And I'm not sure if you all had a chance to look at the website. It is not professionally done. I am more of a policy wonk than a web developer, but this was done by myself and one other colleague last year with input and insight of a variety of state agencies and professionals on the content. And what you'll see there, there's information on the facts about marijuana, information specific to parents. There's information about how to talk to various populations about marijuana, what the laws are, and when to be concerned if someone is using too much, whether that's unintentional or potentially a substance use disorder. So this web portal is intended to be a single access point for the general public to all things related to retail marijuana. We, you know, as I'm sure you all have a similar issue in Oregon, the general public is not very aware of which state agency does what. And so to have one place and point of access into all of the state agency information is very valuable for our public. And so you can access the licensure, you can access the employment concerns related to working in the retail marijuana industry. You can also access through our Department of Human Services their substance use treatment resources. The Department of Education has their comprehensive health education standards and resources for teachers available. So all information across all the state agencies is accessed through that single portal. And we do have some of the resources translated into Spanish. It's a little bit difficult because not all of the state agency, we're still working on getting the state agency sites translated into Spanish, so we could link through to some of those resources. The fourth thing that we were tasked with in our Senate bill was alignment of messages across state agencies and making sure that we're providing resources that address a variety of concerns. For instance, there's not enough funding in our retail marijuana sales tax to fund local substance abuse prevention coalitions, but our Department of Human Services already does that through substance abuse block grant funding. And so this is our task to partner well with those agencies to provide them the resources that they need to work with their grantees or, you know, the Department of Education to be able to work with local school districts. Moving on, the last component on slide 5 that we were tasked with is evaluation of our campaigns. So we have a contracted third-party evaluator looking, they've assessed a baseline survey currently in the field in Spanish. The English is out of the field. They were able to complete the English baseline prior to the launch of the campaign. They also completed a baseline for high risk or targeted subpopulations just to get some oversampling of certain populations that may be harder to reach. And the assessments included knowledge of the laws, knowledge of the health effects, any perceptions of risk, and then health behaviors that are specific to that population. So for instance, when they asked parents, they asked about safe storage. When they asked healthcare providers, they asked about how they talk to their patients about marijuana. And there will be annual or more often kind of it'll be timed based on the campaigns, but at least annual assessments to monitor change. And then we'll also incorporate other data sources to monitor any changes or in trends or behaviors. So I'll stop there just to see if there are any. It's hard when you can't read faces to know if I should keep moving, but I'll stop to see if there's any questions on what we were legislatively mandated to do, and then I'll start to talk about the input and where we've taken the work.
Any questions so far? Yes, sir. Senator Farioli.
Now, this is Senator Ted Farioli from a largely rural part of the state of Oregon. You mentioned that there's not enough revenue in the Colorado program to fund local prevention programs. Could you elaborate on that a little?
Sure. So there's looking at how much it costs to actually run local level communities, following models from, for instance, our tobacco program and their level of funding around across the state for local level implementation. Maybe the total of our marijuana sales tax revenue is reaching that level, but unlike tobacco, there's a lot more state agencies involved in this work with marijuana. So, for instance, our tobacco tax is pretty much only given to public health to be able to do this type of both statewide campaign and local level coalition work. whereas the marijuana sales tax funding that is coming in is going for substance abuse treatment through our Medicaid programs, substance abuse treatment through our Department of Human Services, to pay for substance abuse professionals in schools, to pay for pro-social after-school programs, to support the licensure program that's actually monitoring the monitoring and enforcing compliance with all of the regulations from seed to sale, and authorizing anyone who works in the industry. Not to mention, I'm sure I'm missing a few more. I think there was funding for drug recognition experts and a whole host of other things. So there's a lot more state agencies engaged in this issue, so there just wasn't enough funding to do a multi-million dollar local level funding program in that way. Additionally, we didn't want to duplicate work that was already happening. We already have a lot of local level communities being funded to address substance abuse prevention, and they already have, you know, long-standing support from our State Department of Human Services. The research that we looked at from SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, shows that mass reach media campaigns are effective when they are complemented with local level coalition work. When those coalitions are well-established, well-funded, and given a list of effective strategies that they have to operate from. And that's what's already happening with the Substance Abuse Block Grant within our state.
Hey, Allie. This is Ann. I'm going to jump in. I think Senator Farioli has one more question, and you're doing a bang-up job for someone sitting somewhere in Colorado right now. Thank you.
Thanks. Go ahead, Senator. Hopefully that answered the funding differential there.
It does. Thank you. We have approximately 70,000 marijuana cardholders in Oregon, and I've gotten estimates, just back of the envelope, estimates, that there might be as many as 450,000 recreational users in Oregon. So that would be a six-fold increase, roughly about 15% of the population would be the size of the market. What, if you can, help me understand, what's the size of the recreational marijuana user population relative to the size of the whole population in Colorado?
We are looking at, based on the National Survey on Drug Use and Health data, we don't have any of our statewide surveillance data from 2014 back yet, because those surveys are done all throughout the year, so they just came out of the field in December, and it takes a few months to clean and analyze that data. So really, we only have data from about 2013, and that put us a little over 12% use among adults. And so that, don't quote me on our population, but I think we have 6 million in our state, so 12% would be a little over 600,000.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So we have about... three or four more minutes for your presentation, and then we're going to move into another segment. Is there, so we would love to hear the rest of your thoughts within that frame.
All right, then let's move on to slide number six. Just a little bit about the input that we received in developing the campaign. We were able to, our advertising agency that won the competitive bid did an initial survey with about 180 people to assess the reactions to the topic. They did a stakeholder survey with about 420 people, and also focus group tested the creative with about 450 people to select a winning creative approach. And there was input from the advisory committee. We have it's called the Marijuana Education Oversight Committee, and it's created by the governor's office, and that was outlined in statute as well. And it has representation from the governor's office, the General Assembly, the Department of Revenue, which is the licensing authority, CDE is Department of Education, then Human Services, Transportation, the marijuana industry, et cetera. On the next page, you'll see a little bit, so the Good to Know is really what we're seeing as our umbrella campaign under which some of those prevention campaigns, like for pregnant or breastfeeding women, can operate. So Good to Know targets the general population over age 21 with an overview of the laws. The health effects, because of the timing of the report that just came out last week, they're not as high-level message, but they're in the supplementary materials that are coming out as part of the campaign. It does address the overconsumption of edibles, although that's being addressed on many fronts within the state through regulation as well. And it talks about safe storage. We launched January 5th with radio, web, digital, social media, PR, and we've had more than 13 million media impressions in the first 3 weeks. In another 2 weeks or so, we will launch television, more radio across the state. We didn't quite hit every market yet. And then out of home, which is like billboards or bus ads, and more digital media. So then the ongoing campaigns later this year, we have information at point of sale where we will be trying to hit our tourist population, a Latino Spanish language campaign, and additional information for parents as well as fact sheets. Our youth campaign is pending funding decisions, which is kind of a long story, so I won't go into it. And then next year is when we will, next fiscal year, so after July 1, is when we will launch our Pregnant Breastfeeding Women campaign. On slide 8, you'll see just a brief overview of the creative. That's the slogan, that's the website, and the logo. And that's the homepage that you land on when you visit the website. On page 9, slide 9, you will see an overview of the major messages of the campaign. These were some of the print ads in one of the largest newspapers in the state. So what you get here can't go out there. For those underage, it's just not okay. Their brains are still growing, so keep it away. Store it right, locked up, out of reach, and out of sight. To buy, have, or use some, you must be at least 21. And public space is not the place. So just a brief financial overview. We've estimated that approximately $4 million of our $5.7 million funding is going towards youth prevention because targeting adults with information on the laws and how to restrict youth access is an important aspect of youth prevention. We're also developing clinical prevention guidelines for healthcare providers, marijuana-free schools resources, fact sheets, and then the campaign that targets youth directly. Other prevention efforts and infrastructure make up the remainder of the budget through other adults about safe and legal and responsible use of marijuana, surveillance, which is trend data to track the levels of marijuana use among various populations, evaluating our campaigns, and general staffing. So a quick summary of lessons learned. What has gone very well is the broad range of stakeholders that have been engaged in this process and making sure that you have everyone from your concerned parent groups and substance abuse prevention professionals all the way to the industry themselves and medical marijuana users to make sure that how we talk about retail marijuana doesn't ostracize the medical community either. The systematic literature reviews, I can't stress that enough and how important it's been to all be on the same page of the research. Across state agency collaboration, marijuana has been an issue that's really galvanized relationships across state agencies. And the positive and friendly approach of the campaign has been very successful. If we could start again, timeline is the biggest thing. I mean, our campaign just launched January 2015, but as you'll remember, legal marijuana was first for sale January 2014. But that comes down to funding. You need the sales tax dollars to pay for the campaign, and yet by the time those come in and then you go through the contracting process within the state, the timeline is very difficult to really be relevant. Quality data to target our audiences. As I said, we don't really yet have our 2014 data back to be able to know exact levels of use among which populations, which parts of the state, to be able to target the campaign well. But the one thing I would definitely say is that parent resources first. We've had some resources available for parents, but honestly, the more we could have done sooner, the better. Which is just difficult with the, again, timeline and funding. Any other questions? That's all I have.
Anybody? All right. Well, thank you so much. That was really helpful.
Yes, and we talk regularly with your Department of Public Health, so please feel free to send any questions our way through through those connections.
Fantastic. Thanks. All right, and it is 6 o'clock exactly. Thank you, everybody, for being here for the first hour of our two-hour meeting. And now we're going to close the public hearing on prevention education. I'm leaving it open. This is my first meeting that I'm chairing, so anything could happen.
Madam Chair?
Yes, sir.
I think it would be helpful if we could communicate with our colleagues in Washington and Colorado and ask them if the tobacco companies have been held liable for injury from the use of their products over time. who's liable and responsible for injuries to users like youth for the loss of IQ if the state's the manufacturer, the grower, the distributor, and the retailer?
I see Adam Crawford capturing your question, so thank you for that.
I'd like to hear, I mean, I'm sure that question's come up. I'd like to have their ruminations on it so we can consider that.
Okay.
That's a great question.
Thank you. Thank you. So, you know, I'd just like to wrap up that session by noting that I'm a parent of young teenage kids, and I was a supporter of the Measure 91 campaign, and I think that people, there are good people on all sides of this issue, and we may not agree on a lot of things, but I think we probably do agree on the fact that we want to help kids not get started with using marijuana. We want to make sure people have good information about the rules and safety considerations. So with that, I will evidently not shut the hearing on prevention education, but I will begin another hearing. So now we're going to be talking about laboratory standards. There is, to frame it up, there is some variation we've come to understand in what the testing procedures are in how people go about it, but we all could probably align on the fact it would be useful to have some uniform standards. And to get us started, we're going to have Tom Burns from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, Director of Marijuana Programs, come up. But then I'm going to read to you the series of people. We have a number of wonderful people who have come to share their insights with us today. So we want to make sure we give everyone a chance to speak. We have Roshan Reardon with Greenleaf Labs, Mowgli Holmes from OHSU, I believe. Jeremy Sackett from Cascadia Labs, Jesse Peters from Eco Firma Farms, Jonathan Manson representing some growers in Southern Oregon, and Jeff Sugarman, who has a variety of great insights in roughly that order. And Mr. Burns, if you could get us started, that'd be great. Introduce yourself for the record,
please. Co-chairs and members, I'm Tom Burns. I'm the director of marijuana for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. Got it right this time. Sorry that the last meeting I forgot where I worked. If I might just segue for one moment. We have identified the need to build an education campaign within OLCC and are in the process of working with Ways and Means to try and get money to do that, whether it's us doing it or somebody else to do it. Your conversation today is perfectly appropriate and very spot on when you realize that in 4 months from now, marijuana is legal in this state. And if you meet certain conditions, and the need to make sure that people understand those conditions under which marijuana is legal is something that needs to be addressed. So we're asking for that money, and maybe we will get it now, or maybe we will get it after July 1st. We'll see. So with that, you've asked me for a little history of labs and marijuana in this state. And I'm going to go back into my previous life when I put together the medical marijuana dispensary program. In House Bill 3460, it required that the marijuana be tested for pesticides, molds, and mildew. And that's all it said. It didn't talk about labs. It didn't say how that testing was to be done. It was not addressed. Fast forward to Measure 91. The word laboratory and testing do not appear in that measure. However, I think it is very important that that we do find some way to test product that is going to be consumed either by inhaling or swallowing or chewing or whatever you do to consume this product, that it be tested so you know that it is at least what it says it is. I almost said the word safe, but we could debate whether marijuana is safe for a long time. But so we know for sure that there are no pesticides, molds, that when you buy a product and it says on that product that it has 27% potency, that in fact it is 27% potency. It didn't work on the medical side. It didn't work on the medical side because the only authority we had was the dispensary. And so what we said to dispensaries is, you, the dispensary, need to go find a laboratory. Where do we find a laboratory? You need to go find a laboratory. What's that laboratory going to look like? You need to decide what that laboratory is going to look like as long as it provides testing results. And what this has led to, unfortunately, is some inaccurate results. Not all labs have the same standards. Not all labs do the testing the same way. The information is not always accurate. The consumers who are consuming this medicine on that side and on the Measure 91 side as recreational may be at risk because the brownie that it is in may have something in it other than whatever goes into making a brownie in addition to the marijuana. It creates a problem without some formal authority. And so the solution is to find out what that ought to look like. And so I've spent a lot of time, when I was on the marijuana medical side, I spent a lot of time trying to figure this out. One thing is there is a state agency that looks at and certifies all labs in the state. That agency is the Oregon Health Authority Laboratory Program called ORLAP. I don't know enough about labs to tell you whether ORLAP is in fact the right standards, but some entity that knows what a laboratory is ought to be certifying the lab as, yes, you have the right staff, you have the right equipment, you have the right processes to guarantee that the result will be the same regardless of whether you're doing it or another lab is doing it. The results ought to be the same from both labs. Once the laboratory gets that certification from OHA or some other state standard, please don't ask OLCC to do it. That's not what our expertise is. Then the laboratory would come to OLCC and get permission to handle marijuana. And they need that permission because they would not be protected under the law for having more than 8 ounces of product in their possession or for transporting marijuana from point A to point B. I wish I could claim that what I had handed out to you, a little slide looked like this, I understand was posted on our list this morning, is mine. You're going to hear from Mowgli, but I just want, it's actually his slide. I wish I had found Mowgli 2 years ago when I was doing this, because he's the first time somebody took a very complicated issue and made a dummy like me understand what a laboratory is. But this graph is designed to show the way product would move. So on the right, left-hand side would be where the growers are. It says flowers and trim. Flowers would be tested for potency, pesticides, and microbials, and it would then go to the retail storefront, or if for some reason it needed to, it would go to extract. Trim, which is the leaf, the stem, the non-quality smokable stuff, would go directly to the extract maker because the process of extracting would kill most anything that might be on that product. The extract maker would then extract the product and test for potencies, pesticides, solvents. Remember, they're extracting this from very high, dangerous, whatever term you want to use, solvents, propane, butane. So if the solvents remain in the product, it ought to know, and the customer ought to know. Again, it will be tested and sent to the retail outlet, or it could go over to the kitchen. And the kitchen would, again, not be certified by OLCC, but certified by a commercial kitchen license that the Department of Agriculture gives. They would get that license. Again, they'd come to us for a license to make a brownie. The extract would go to the brownie, and the brownie would be made and then, again, tested for potency before it goes to the market. All of these various tests need to be put in place in order to guarantee that the consumer is getting what the consumer thinks he's getting. Without doing this, you run risks. The risks are what we have out there currently right now, and that is that you get different results depending upon where you send your results, your product. You get different results depending on whether you are an expert in testing edibles or an expert in testing concentrate or an expert in testing flour. The results are different, and it becomes a problem for the consumer. The whole issue over on the infused product side is an interesting one, because not only are extracts made through the solvents, but there are extracts made by putting it in butter or water that may not be a solvent, but are putting it through butter and water. And, you know, I've heard a story of you take 10 pounds of butter and you put 10 pounds of marijuana in a turkey roaster and you turn it on for 200 degrees and walk away for 3 days. And then you come back, you filter it out, and the marijuana has been extracted into the butter, and the butter is used to make brownies. I don't know, but without testing, we don't know what may have been transferred to that butter, and we don't know, therefore, what was transferred to the brownie and what was transferred to the patient or the consumer. So this is not mine, it's Mowgli's, but I do think that as you debate this issue, that it is important that you get a handle around the whole laboratory issue, because right now laboratories are not mentioned in 91, and they are not mentioned on the medical side, and that's a problem for both sides of this. I'll be happy to answer any questions or let people smarter than me wade into it.
All right, Senator Farrelly.
I'm fascinated by this because what it talks to, or at least what it speaks to me about, is product purity. And that is connected to the question of liability for the purity and accuracy of the description so that the consumer can be informed. So, but it also talks to me about product liability. Who has the liability for injury or for the failure of the testing lab to meet standards or impure product entering the marketplace when we're the licensor of the grow, the processing testing lab, the processing facility, the kitchen, the distributor, and the retailer? Who's got the liability?
Chair Leininger, Senator Ferrioli, I'm not a lawyer. I don't know. I will tell you that the medical program was built, that it was the dispensary's responsibility to get the testing done and to provide those results to their patient. But that's as far as we went on that side. The question of whether there would be liability to the state or liability to a medical marijuana dispensary or over on the recreational side to the grower or the kitchen, somebody who has more years of education than I do will have to answer that.
It's a good question to place, Mark, though. I don't see any other hands up, but I do know – oh, yes, I do. Senator Beyer, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Burns, you mentioned the medical lab testing. Did you look at all at the Department of Ag? They have a lot of weights and measures and dairy testing. That they do that as well.
Yeah. Co-Chair Leininger, Senator Beyer. I don't understand enough about who does various testing. To me, a laboratory is what does tests for pesticides, molds, mildews, potency, contaminated product. Now, the argument that you are bringing up is this an agricultural product? And should an agricultural product go through a different route? I don't know, and I'm not sure I care, as long as there is some standard in place that we can be assured that the product is tested before it reaches the consumer.
Yeah, I wasn't making that distinction. I was just saying that they do some of this testing as well, food standards and that. I don't know which one makes the most sense, yeah. But there's at least two, and there's another one for health standards at OHSU. Used to be called CROAT. I can never remember what it's called now. But there's a couple of places in the state that do that.
Senator Prozanski and then Senator Cruz.
I just think that's an issue that we need to put down as to what we may want to go. There's multiple facets to weights and measures, one thing. But when you're talking about consumption or items that are going to be consumed in the body,
packaging
is going to be a significant issue.
I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. Senator Cruz.
It's similar on that, and because Senator Beyer's right, the Department of Ag does a lot of product testing. I would suggest that we don't spread this program out to every agency in the state. We try to keep it captured in a smaller number as we can.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. So I'm not seeing any of our House members with questions. Actually, oh, yes, I am.
Yeah, Madam Chair, actually, I do. let me ask about the medical program here. Since by its very name it's called a medical program, I'm kind of amazed, as mature as this program is and as long as it's been around, there were no real certified labs involved, no standards involved. I'm not sure how that happened. How did that happen?
Chair Leininger, Representative Wilson, I don't know. House Bill 3460 was written without input from OHA, or leastwise at my level had no input to it. We got it. We read it. It required testing. We did what we could to require the testing. Our only authority was over the dispensary itself, so we put the burden on the dispensary to certify that the product was tested. But that places the dispensary in the odd position of taking product and having it tested and hoping it comes back at the level they can sell it at. And it puts either the dispensary or the laboratory in a bind of perhaps wanting to see specific results be produced.
Senator Cruz,
yeah,
and then Senator
Okay, Burnett. Answer to Representative Wilson. Until we went to dispensaries, the relationship was between a grower and a patient, and so it was a direct relationship. So that wasn't really an issue at that point in time until we got into dispensaries, which is still relatively new.
Senator Burnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for the record, there's no testing requirement when there's a direct relationship between the grower and the patient. Is that correct?
Co-chairs, the answer, Senator, is yes. That's correct. It is a patient-to-grower relationship, a one-on-one relationship.
And to follow up, Madam Chair, in your experience in the medical marijuana program, were there any issues with that, with the lack of potency or contaminant testing? Were there cases where people had bad outcomes because of that?
Yeah. Co-Chair Leininger, Senator Burdick, bad outcomes I can't speak to because I haven't heard from a patient who has complained. What I can say is that as we would go into a medical marijuana dispensary and look at the testing results, you would oftentimes find two tests for the same product and wonder why, and the tests were different. You would find a brownie, for example, that said it was, 350 micrograms of THC in the brownie, but when another lab did it, it was 50 micrograms of THC in the brownie. The reason for that is simply because, I think, is because there was no standard by which the laboratory were required to function.
So, Mr. Burns, thank you so much for this. We have the privilege of speaking with some people from the sector who have been helping us pioneer how we're going to make this work and creating systems as we go. I want to make sure that we reserve enough time for each of them who've driven a long way to speak with us. And I know we'll continue to talk to you about this, and I suspect we're going to continue to talk about this issue because what we're doing now is flagging for further work, something that's a meaty, important subject. So thank you for your work. You may leave the hot seat, but you're still going to be on the hot seat.
I'm not going very well.
And now I'd like to welcome up to the front Roshan Reardon, who is one of the founders and co-owners of a lab called Greenleaf Labs up in North Portland. Mowgli Holmes, who's with Phylos Bioscience. If you could please come up too, sir, and Jeremy Sackett of Cascadia Labs. And I want to thank each of you for being here. If you have not testified before a House committee before, I just want to say you're talking to the wrong person because this is my first night chairing one of these meetings. But I do know that, if you could start, please, by introducing yourself for the record and then let us know in your experience what issues you see about the potential need for standards or problems that you've encountered based on lack of them or suggestions you have on this issue. That would be great. If you could each take about 5 minutes, that would be perfect. And Ms. Reardon, you may begin.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I really appreciate it. It's such an honor to be here. My name is Roshan Reardon. Excuse me. I'm a licensed attorney in the state of Oregon. I received my license in 2006. I also have a master's degree in political science with a concentration in human rights. I opened my laboratory in 2011 before Oregon knew what testing was, before there was any conversation even about potency or safety for cannabis. And it was really interesting times educating people about the importance for testing. Excuse me. My business, I have 12 employees. 10 of them are full-time. 10 of them have all backgrounds in chemistry or some type of science. The reason I opened my laboratory is because I have a friend who is terminally ill, and he's also an OMMP cardholder and patient, and he had consumed cannabis, and it negatively impacted his already compromised immune system. And at that point, I realized that this industry, thank you so much, this industry lacked standards for testing, and it was just so important for us to have science behind this upcoming industry, especially if we're stating it is medical. And I also believe for consumers themselves, they should just have that right to know and have scientific information for educated choices. We've run into a few different issues having a laboratory that's unregulated. First of all, I know that the legislatures are supportive of regulation, and I'm really excited about that. It's high time we have regulation. I know a lot of our customers are really frustrated with no regulation, as well as patients who consume cannabis right now. What we're hoping for is that the legislature and the committee will consider having an Oregon-regulated organization for Oregon-based businesses. Excuse me. We are hoping that this industry will follow national standards, which are more stringent than international standards. So whatever the industry or organization is, we hope that you guys will consider that. I really believe that there should be stringent testing standards for cannabis. We also believe there should be independent third-party testing. It's an inherent conflict of interest right now if a dispensary can test the medicine that they sell and put on their shelves, which is currently allowed under the rules. We also believe that there should be proper random sampling and chain of custody systems so that we can verify what that product is that we're testing and what that larger quantity is that it represents. So that would be some type of a batch testing certification system where a lab can certify or potentially package with tamper-proof seals what that quantity is. We also believe that and ask the state to decide really what that batch size is and what that limit is. Another issue we've run into is right now under the rules, testing is allowed and for mold and mildew, and it can be tested up to 10,000 colony-forming units per gram. The issue with that is it doesn't specify harmful molds or mildews or aflatoxins. And so right now what we're doing is we'll find a test that passes under the current rules, but it might have black mold, it could have aspergillus, any of these really harmful molds. And so we're hoping that there'll be more specificity on the specific mold testing that's required. We also hope there will be more specificity on pesticide testing and including options for OMRI listed products, which are organic listed products that are viable and usable in organic industry. I'm really hoping for standardized methods and potency testing. Potency testing is a huge issue that I run into having my laboratory. Potency testing, really there's such a variable we're seeing in results, and not only does that not protect consumers because they don't know necessarily the strength of their medicine, but it also allows, there's variables that are occurring if laboratories don't have the same methods. So a method is essentially like a recipe for cooking or an instruction manual. And so a method is something that right now all laboratories have their own self-validated methods. So like me as my lab, I have a method that I use and I validate it, and that could be considered like a correct method if I follow certain procedures. Another laboratory as well has their own self-validated method. And we're really hoping that there will be some type of method structure that is equal among all laboratories. So there really is consistency. And one of the issues for that is cannabis itself is not consistent in its results. I mean, we've seen variables on 10% sometimes on the same plant for the flower. And so if you have a variable on your plant and the sampling, and then you have a variable with a laboratory, it just is recipe for creating a lot of confusion and chaos. We also ask for residual solvent testing for concentrates. Right now, there are people who make concentrates with machinery, that metal machinery, as well as butane or propane. And so with the residual solvent testing, we're able to analyze and see what type of solvents might be left over. I remember this one story, like a few years ago, I was at a cannabis cup, and this was right when concentrate making was just starting to begin. And there was a company selling butane, little butane cartridges. And I looked at the gentleman, and he was pasty and white, and he looked so unhealthy. And I was thinking, wow, I mean, we need to have some type of standard where we can see what type of residual solvents might be left over in these concentrates or in these products. And he was just, there was a glaring, I wish I'd taken a picture of it now, actually, to show people. And so really what we're hoping for is laboratory testing standards that protect public health and that also are affordable, because we really do want to see a successful system. We want to see public safety, and we want to see people participate in this program.
Thank you. That's perfect, and perfectly within our time frame. I'm going to go to the rest of the panel before we open it up to questions. Mr. Peters, if you could go next, and then Mr. Holmes, because I think you are also run a lab.
My name is Jeremy Sackett.
I'm sorry, Mr. Sackett.
Operate Cascadia Labs.
That's right.
Would you like me to go next?
Yes, I would.
Thank you, Representative Langer. My name is Jeremy Sackett. I'm the co-founder and director of operations at Cascadia Labs. My background is biochemical pharmacology. A career path as an analytical chemist and a project manager in the pharmaceutical industry. I'd like to speak tonight about laboratory regulation and standards, obviously. I'd like to break that down into essentially two areas of this sector of the industry that can be regulated. One is what Roshan was speaking to, the overall standard practices of laboratories. And that's a standard that is set, such as ISO 17025, that outlines general practices that must be followed by each laboratory. An accreditation body or an inspector, either somebody from a state agency or a third party, would come against a standard, essentially a checklist of items that need to be met to ensure that laboratory is operating correctly. Part of that, along with standardized methodology, there is an opportunity for multiple, different methodology and the advancement of methodology, as long as you are doing that validation, as Roshan spoke to. The difficulty right now is that the validation is within single laboratories. If there was an inspecting body that came with a standard of practice to show that different attributes of that method were met, they are certified to operate with that method. Anyways, that's a bit of detail. The overall areas of regulation are those quality standards that must be met, as well as the tests for each product and the limits within each product. So those are two separate issues to contemplate. One is the quality standards that must be met, and that is across the board, every industry that has a product that is brought to market that is consumed by humans has to meet operational standards within their facility. The second component for where regulation can be deployed is the characterization of the different product types, an edible, a concentrate, a flower. Each of those are going to have different critical quality attributes that need to be tested for, and the lists of tests for each of those products will be different, and that's a second body of regulation. There's opportunities for, as Tom mentioned, the Office of Public Health Laboratories, the Laboratory Compliance Section, that I do believe is best suited to perform these inspections to the standard that is chosen. They currently operate programs in environmental laboratory accreditation, clinical lab regulation, health screen testing permits, substance of abuse lab registration, and the laboratory response network. So if they were able to utilize the systems, the personnel, the know-how that they have within their office, bring in additional stakeholders, experts in certain areas, they would be easily able to deploy a cannabis laboratory accreditation program that is utilized inspectors, either third party or state employees. Let's see. So, the current ORLAP program is a great model, but there's some technical nuances that it doesn't directly translate to the cannabis space. There needs to be some adjustment. I've made a recommendation in the written testimony of potentially an outline that could be used in statutory language to create a program similar to ORLAP that would effectively inspect and regulate cannabis laboratories. So yes, the ORLAP program is a great starting point and should overall be utilized, but is needs some additional expansion of scope and some just revisions. I do believe, as Tom said, that there's two aspects of laboratory accreditation. One is the quality and technical standpoint, and also is diversion control. The Oregon Health Authority is best suited in the laboratory compliance section, in my opinion, to evaluate the quality and technical aspects, while the OLCC or the OHA within the medical program could be looking at diversion control. So I know that may be a lot really fast, but in essence of time, hopefully, you know, there's, you know, looking at those different quality management systems, 17025 is a great basis. It's internationally recognized. Within the written testimony, there's some details, and there's also a handout from the international body that does provide accreditation. And those do translate down into the national standards that we currently use and can be expanded upon to be specific to the cannabis program. Thank you very much for your time. And
that's great. Yes, Representative Olson.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Just a real quick question. as far as lab equipment goes, is there just certain equipment on the approved list? Consumer grade, industrial grade?
That's a great question. So the analytical instruments that are used, you can use any equipment or any method within a regulated industry, such as the pharmaceutical industry. You know, there are standardized methods that are, you know, for this, you can use this. But you have the option, if you meet criteria with a method validation and you've demonstrated that to the inspectors, that you can utilize a different piece of equipment if you meet these criteria. Okay. And can show that you can accurately use it with your method, with your equipment.
Great, thank you.
All right. Well, that was really helpful. And now, Mr. Holmes, if you could share your thoughts, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, thanks for having me. So my name is Mowgli Holmes. I'm the co-founder of a Portland biotech company called Phylos Bioscience. My co-founder, Nishan Karasik, is here with me.
Hi.
I have a PhD in microbiology, and I'm also a board member of a group called the Cannabis Safety Institute, and the executive director, Bethany Sherman, is here as well. So this group, the Cannabis Safety Institute, formed to address this whole set of issues. And I know they can be really complicated, and there's a lot of detail here. I guess I just want to give kind of an overview of what went wrong in the states that did not do this right. So Washington and Colorado did not do this right. They didn't have effective safety testing. They're only just now starting to figure it out. We didn't have it here in Oregon for a little while in the window of time when we had to have testing, but it wasn't clear how to do the testing. But to be fair, I think Oregon was the first medical program that even made a stab at it. And I think the problem is that all of this exists in a weird legal zone where people don't know how to regulate it and they don't know who's in charge, and it's just been complicated. In other industries, this is not a problem. So safety testing, what you put on labels, contaminant testing, this is all stuff that is really well understood. Food safety testing is the best model system for it. But it's not, I mean, all of us have 100 million details about how it should be done. But it's known how to do it. The real question is just where state legislators or regulators go to find that information. So what the other states did wrong is that they kind of decided that some safety testing would be better than no safety testing at all. So a lot of labs have sprung up all over that do this testing, but no one's regulating them. So they're stamping stuff with values and safety-tested stamps that aren't true. And also the states didn't know what to test for. So Washington and Colorado both decided to do safety testing, and they both came up with totally different lists of things to test for. I mean, they were both, you know, they were good faith tries, but they didn't really talk to any scientists about it. So they both wanted to do microbiology testing, but they're testing for a totally different list of organisms. So the reason why this matters is that there's a few contaminants of marijuana that are actually scary. They're not very common. One of them is getting more common. That's pesticides. Pesticide use is really increasing. And with this new industry, it's going to keep increasing. People are increasingly using concentrated products to make food products. And those concentrates concentrate pesticides. So some of the labs in Oregon have recently found cannabis concentrates that have, I think, over 3,000 times the EPA suggested level of certain dangerous pesticides. So at a certain point in Colorado, they weren't testing concentrates for pesticides at all. I'm not sure what they're doing now. They're in flux. They're trying to change it. The people who work with our group, thank you so much, are working in Colorado too. My overall point about all of this is that when you look at all the literature and you get a group of scientists together, it becomes pretty clear what to test for. And our group has tried to put together a document covering each of the different things, pesticides, heavy metals, microbiology, and we're just completing all of those. As Jeremy said, that's one set of issues, what you test for. The other set of issues is how you make sure that your labs are actually laboratories. And there, again, we don't need to reinvent that. There's a nationally and internationally accepted standard for a safety testing laboratory. It's called ISO 17025. They both mentioned it. That standard is what defines a real safety testing laboratory. Most of the government laboratories at state and federal levels are ISO 17025 certified. There are third-party accreditation bodies that's what they do. They come and they make sure that you meet those standards. They can customize how they do that for different industries. They know about the cannabis industry. They'll be happy to customize things for the cannabis industry. But that certification is how you know when you're dealing with a real lab. Mm. That's not enough by itself. In addition to that, you probably do need a state program that once a lab is ISO certified, they can come to the state and get a license from the state that pays attention to the cannabis aspect, the diversion control aspect, how things are packed, how things are labeled, tracking numbers, that kind of thing. And then there's a third part, which is inter-lab proficiency testing. So you don't need to tell labs what methods to use. You just make sure they pass their proficiency tests, and this is how it's done in the rest of the world. There's ISO-certified bodies that have standards, and they send them out. Certain amounts of salmonella, they send the same amount to every lab, and then all the labs tell you how much salmonella was in that sample. And the labs that blow it, they lose their accreditation. So there's a playbook for all of this, and we can get it in your hands, and I don't think it'll be so hard if you guys are more concerned about it than they were in Washington and Colorado, and it seems like you are.
Yeah. Well, great. Thank you. That's really helpful. I mean, again, we're not going to solve the problem or answer the question today, but we are sure identifying some good steps. Senator Farrelly, I believe you have some questions.
Just one quick statement and then a question. First, I'm getting a slew of emails that flatly state opposition to any departure from Measure 91. You know, don't subtract a jot or a tittle and don't add anything. So we're already out of that territory. If we take this admonition seriously and embark on a laboratory testing for patient safety, it's a big departure from 91. So there's one. I'm not going to keep track of all of them. I think we can write the protocols, Madam Chair. I think that's really clear, and we can use the templates that are already out there. But I'm not sure what I'm hearing is that the state of Oregon ought to get into testing the testers. So I'd like to hear a recommendation for somebody other than the state of Oregon to do the cross-checking with laboratories to make sure that everybody's meeting the protocols, you know, staying, coloring between the lines, following staying ISO certified, but also delivering a consistent result without us doing the testing as we do with weights and measures with the Department of Agriculture. I don't want to get in the testing business, Madam Chair.
It's an interesting observation, so, Mr. Holmes.
There's two bodies that are qualified to do that, that their job is to go around and accredit laboratories. Most states don't have a good one. Oregon does have a good one. It's ORLAP. They are the body that accredits environmental testing laboratories. And the checklist they use is not ISO 17025, but it's basically the same. It's based on it.
Madam Chair, I'm really aiming not at the accreditation of the laboratory. You've been very clear about that.
Okay.
What's maybe not so clear is a laboratory does a routine batch of testing. Who does the sampling to make sure that what they say is their test results actually checks at some third party?
So usually, I see what you're saying, I think. So as if a laboratory would do a lot of tests and then someone would come test the lab. So the way that the lab is testing the manufacturer, someone would then come test the lab.
Measure the outputs.
So the way that works is with inter-lab proficiency testing.
Okay.
So part of the accreditation process is the labs have to meet these proficiency tests. And usually the way that's done is not by going around and taking products that the labs have tested and retesting them at another lab. That creates an infinite loop. The way you do it is you have an inter-lab proficiency testing body that sends out these test packages. And you do that regularly. And that makes it so the labs can prove that their methods are working.
And so that answers my question.
Great.
Thank you.
So I think Representative Buckley has a question, and then Representative Helm, do you have one? And then I'd like to have us transition to the last group of three, because they, too, have been very patient and traveled a long way. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, all three of you, for your presentation. And I think the idea of having statewide standards obviously makes sense. This is, again, as Senator Cruz mentioned, with the dispensaries, we're entering in a whole new world, and this is now taking a further step. So your expertise is definitely helpful for all of us. We look forward to hearing what the Center for Cannabis Safety, when you come back to us, I wonder what your timeline might be in coming back to us on the report of the information that you're working on.
So we distributed a white paper that we finalized on laboratory standards. I think you guys have that already.
Is that 14-page document? Was it attached?
I think that's the document, yeah.
All right.
We have another document that we distributed that you might not have gotten yet, but it was distributed today, which is an overview of all the different safety testing issues that are going to come up in the implementation of Measure 91 that we know of.
Great.
And then we're doing specific documents on microbiology, pesticides, and heavy metals. The pesticides and heavy metals ones should be done within 2 weeks. The microbiology one, we have a draft complete. It's just being sent out to all the board members for review. We have a draft that we could share informally if anyone wants to see it.
Thank you. Quick follow-up?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Sackett, great work on this report. You've gone down to a lot of detail in terms of how you'd like to set up the process here. Have you thought about the interaction? We're trying to keep the tax level low, the cost low, to compete with the black market. Do you have any kind of estimates on what kind of cost you're talking about adding to the product through this sort of process?
Right. That's a very good question and a great concern. So the two areas of regulation that I discussed, the quality management system is, you know, a sunk cost of operating a quality control laboratory. Where the cost can be addressed is getting that team of scientists and people, experts together to look at the different product types, characterize those product types, and look at if, you know, for instance, microbiology was something that could be a risk to human health if that was consumed in that product type, we would test for that. So it's not a blanket mold, pesticides, potency for everything. You know, edibles have their own set of tests. Extracts have their own set of tests. Flower has their own set of tests. And those can be shorter, longer, depending on what the risk is for each of those product types. For instance, the edible products would have additional food safety requirements, as any food would. You know, flour and or extracts would not have those requirements. So it's variable based on the product type and the number of tests that need to be done on that product to ensure that it's well characterized.
Well, I appreciate any information you get, and I'd love to have you come to my office and just figure out what kind of price range you might think might impact the product.
Right.
Representative Holmes. Oh, okay. We've got that covered. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Holmes.
Sorry, could I just speak to that question really quickly?
Sure.
Senator Farrelly, when you get these emails from their constituents who don't want 91 changed at all, I think to some extent they just hadn't thought about safety testing, probably, some of those people, and it seems like there wouldn't be pushback about this. There is one place where there might be pushback, and that's on the cost. And the growers, the wholesale prices are very low in the state. They are worried that that extra regulation will add to the cost and that it will make it impossible for them to survive. So what Jeremy is saying is that there's ways around that. And one way is you don't test for anything you don't need to. You test for what you actually have to test for. And you have to think really hard about that. So for pesticides, our group is working on narrowing down the list of pesticides that you test for at the USDA level, which is a $500 test. We don't think the market will bear that. Most of those pesticides aren't available. So we can whittle that list down. But what we're looking at, I think we can give you a number roughly. Okay. So labs are doing $100 tests now for everything, and that's not adequate. They're having to not test for things that they really should test for. Especially pesticides. Pesticide testing is important and expensive. We don't know the answer to this, but we think it's going to be more in the $300 range per batch to do pesticides and potency and all that. And the way to not make it kill people is you make the batch sizes a little bigger. We're thinking maybe 6 pounds.
So there's clearly a lot of good conversation that we'll need to have following up on this panel presentation. But thank you again to the three of you for coming up. And I'm going to now invite our last group of three people to come up. This is a very important.
Thank you so much.
And you'll be hearing from us, I have a feeling.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Just before they leave, I'd like to encourage Ms. Reardon, Rofian, to put her comments in OLIS. I'm seeing the other ones, but I'm not seeing written comments, and we'd appreciate having those.
Thank you.
So this last group of speakers represents a really important perspective. It represents the perspective of growers. And as we try to come up with a way to regulate the adult use of marijuana in a safe and fair and reasonable way, an important group of stakeholders is going to also be the folks. Sometimes we get emails from people about concerns about additions to any overlays on Measure 91, but I've also gotten a lot of communication from people saying, hey, we want reasonable, fair standards that don't interfere with the voter's intent but help fill gaps. And what I'm hoping we can get out of this next panel is just a first reaction to what you think about the concerns and priorities around lab testing standards and where we are right now. We have Jesse Peters from Ecofirma Farms, Jonathan Manton on behalf of Oregon Sun Grown Growers Guild, and Jeff Sugarman on behalf of some growers, another group of growers, and you're welcome to introduce yourselves in whatever words are most fitting. But thank you for your patience, and thank you for coming here. Mr. Peters, if you'd like to go first, that would be wonderful.
Representative Leininger, Co-Chair Burdick, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, thanks for having me here tonight. My name is Jesse Peters. I own Ecofirma Farm, which is a garden that supplies medical marijuana to medical patients and to medical marijuana dispensaries under House Bill 3460. I also am a 20-year vet.
Could you move back from the mic? It's very sensitive.
Oh,
thank you.
I'm also a 20-year veteran of the United States Marine Corps and work as a professional firefighter here in the state of Oregon. I could recap a lot of what's been said here tonight. On behalf of the Oregon Growers Political Action Committee, which I'm speaking for today, we're in agreement with the regulation of the labs, ISO 17025, especially ORLAB. We think these are great certifications for the labs to take on. Something that we're really looking for is that consistency amongst testing and being able to bring our product to labs that are certified. everyone tonight spoke about great certification systems, and I feel as though we're all on the same page moving in that direction. One thing that was not touched on and that I think can be touched on in regards to price and what the growers are concerned about was control. So the chain of custody and ensuring that product that is brought in to a lab and is tested is what the consumer is getting. And one piece to that I think that's important is the random testing. And as growers, hopefully, are brought in to be regulated as well, which we are very much welcoming, we then have control over us, similar to dispensaries, where a governing body can come in and regulate and see our quantity on hand, our batch sizes, which then correlate with the testing numbers that have come from said lab. Being able to do that brings the price down. For example, if I own a large farm here as we move forward into recreational, and I produce 30 pounds of one specific strain, if I have to absorb a $300 testing fee to have those to have that tested, I bring in the sample to the lab. I then bring it back, have my test result with a very on the test results a very specific number, 30 pounds, 4 ounces, 3 grams. Just like a dispensary currently. I then can always be audited at any point in time or randomly tested to ensure that any product in that batch is clear of pesticide and that every piece of that batch is accounted for when it goes out, when it comes in, how much is there in that batch and not in that batch. That makes that test more than manageable, and I then do not have to pass that cost on to the consumer, thus driving price down, and in turn, helping regulate things getting out to the black market. Because in the end, the black market is going to be regulated by price. And I think we've seen a lot of that in Washington. Consumers that need to spend $65, $55 on a gram of marijuana, that drives them to the black market. Being able to batch our own samples as growers, fall under regulation, and then present that to dispensaries with our control over the product and our responsibility for keeping it in our safekeeping the entire time is what's going to drive the price back down and make competition to where growers want to come. They want to participate. They want to be regulated. I think this is a really important piece. It's the logistics of how this all comes together, I think, is the key. And we spoke earlier about potency testing, and Rashawn's absolutely right. Potency testing in plants alone, we have been testing as a farm since 2011, far before it was ever required, so we could understand better what we're producing and what we're providing. Potency is all over the board genetically with strains of marijuana. Some will only float a couple of percent from the top to the bottom of the plant. Some will float a vast percentage. This is part of the reason why I believe it's the responsibility of the grower to be able to bring their sample to the lab to have it tested and choose their sample, and I'll give you an example why. A strain of marijuana that tests at, say, 27% THC at the very top of the plant, that is the most potent part of the plant. To present that to someone as 27%, if they get the bottom part of the plant and it comes in at, say, 17%, they may be a little disappointed. Conversely, if someone comes in looking for something in the 17% range and accidentally gets the top of the plant because in a random sample that was taken from 30 pounds, they wound up getting a smaller portion of the plant, they're going to get something, they're going to believe they're getting something less potent. It's no different than me handing someone a glass of wine or a shot of 151 with no taste difference, and the only way that you know afterwards is after consuming.
That's very helpful. So we have two more speakers, and I'd love to have you each have a chance to offer your perspectives. That was extremely helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jonathan Manton, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Sun-Grown Growers Guild, which is a group of outdoor marijuana growers and with its roots in Southern Oregon, growing for the medical program. And Just very pleased to be here today. I want to first say thank you to the each of you for expressing the sentiments that you shared at the first meeting that we had last week. There was nothing that any of you said there that I think anyone that I've spoken to in the community in Southern Oregon and elsewhere would disagree with. I think this is shared values, shared sentiments, and look forward to working with you all as we move forward. Especially want to say thank you to those of you who have been able to come down and visit with some of the grow sites and meet some of the folks in Southern Oregon. I know like even Adam coming down as well. And Tom, that you know, certainly that's not necessarily in any of your job descriptions, and you come all the way down very far away to visit with a kind of a long drive from here, and it's just very much appreciated that you'd be doing to do that, and want to make sure that that invitation is extended to everyone on the committee to come down and meet with folks as well. On the issue of testing, and I'll share just the Guild beliefs that sustainable sun-grown agricultural methods produce a superior holistic medicine. And on the matter of testing, the OSGG believes that the best way to promote safe marijuana is to allow growers to contract with a certified lab of their choice who have batch testing procedures in place and can package the products with tamper-proof seals. We support state certification of independent labs because without it, just as Jesse had mentioned, labs could provide widely varying services, results, and techniques. So we just believe that growers should be able to find a certified lab that meets their needs at a freely negotiated price, and that this is the best way for efficient and safe flow of usable marijuana to patients.
That's helpful. Thank you. Mr. Sugarman.
Co-Chair Leininger, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Sugarman. I am the lobbyist for the Oregon Cannabis Growers PAC. I really have not a lot to add that you haven't heard already today. When we wrote 3460 2 years ago, for the first time we did put in those requirements for testing, and we thought we had that testing covered by giving the OHA authority to write those rules. We were wrong. It's time that we do harmonize this program, the medical marijuana program, and the adult use program, so that we have licensed, certified, and inspected labs, that we have consistency in testing, that we ensure that consumers and patients get the right kind of medicine. At the Cannabis Growers PAC, we are anxiously looking for that licensure and that regulation. Our books are open. Our farms are open. We would love to have you come down there, and we are ready to work with this committee on all of the issues that you heard today, and I'd rather open it up for questions than talk anymore. Thank you.
Anybody have any questions, comments? Well, then I'll make the observation that from what I've heard, although the people who spoke tonight represent probably a wide range in views, I see a lot of common ground, and I see probably an ability for us to get to an outcome on prevention investments in education and also on lab standards and testing that everyone in the community can feel good about, wherever people are or have been on Measure 91. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to ask if anyone has announcements. Chair Burdick, if you would like to speak to what we're going to be talking about on Wednesday. You could give a quick preview.
Happy to do that, Madam Chair. On Wednesday, we will be having a thorough overview on the medical marijuana program and how it works and lessons that can be learned and maybe sometimes unlearned from that program that's been in effect for quite a while. So it should be a good, and we'll see some of the same faces.
That's right. It'll be great. Any other announcements? All right. Thank you, everybody. And we'll be great. Any other announcements? All right. Thank you, everybody. And